Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are tuned into another episode of Real College Podcast, Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. Ice hockey, hot dish, meat raffles, caribou coffee, Paul Bunyan, and Ope, excuse me, are all quintessentially Minnesotan things to say, do, discuss, or consume. However, most of these stereotypically Minnesotan things have one thing in common. They originated from white immigrants. So what does being Minnesotan truly mean? Whose Minnesota is it? In this extra special episode of Real College Podcast, we will attempt to answer these questions and more by looking beyond the stereotypes and delving deeper into the true Minnesotan culture that makes this state great. We will attempt to understand where the land that the University of Minnesota was built on came from, take a dive into the controversy surrounding some of the building names on campus, have conversations with a local Minnesotan who is striving for change, and discover what is going on with efforts to legalize sports betting. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. Since the founding of the 13 original colonies in 1607, settlers in the United States have appropriated native lands for their own uses. In an attempt to understand how the land on which the University of Minnesota operates came to be in the school's possession, reporter Casey Salazar did some digging in her final piece for the podcast. Here is Casey with more.
A typical day on campus can vary for each student. I remember for me, my routine was to head to Starbucks, then eventually head my way to Murphy Hall, where I would probably have a journalism class, and then I would head over to Fowl Hall for one of my Spanish classes. After that, during my breaks in between classes or after class, I would probably take a walk down to one of the libraries, either Walter on the East Bank or Wilson on West Bank, and study and work on homework for the rest of the day. Well, why do I talk about a typical day on campus? Just to get you thinking, as you walk throughout campus and you enter and you exit buildings, you travel from East to West Banks to the St. Paul campus, have you ever questioned yourself, whose land are we walking on when we walk around the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus?
This part of Minnesota where the Twin Cities campus is was Dakota land, although there have been indigenous peoples on the lands of Minnesota from time immemorial.
I had a conversation with Professor Ted Johnson, who 25% of his time is the Director of Graduate Studies in the American Indian Studies Department at the University of Minnesota Duluth. And 75% of his time, Professor Ted Johnson is the Senior Director of American Indian Tribal Nations Relations for the entire University of Minnesota system. He explains the history behind acquiring the land, the one that the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus currently sits on.
The Dakota were here when a treaty got made in 1851. And then when the Morrill Act passed in 1862, which is the land grant university law, mainly Dakota land was provided and taken and sold to build the University of Minnesota.
In order to acknowledge that Native Americans occupied the land where the U of M sits, the university has released land acknowledgement statements for its campuses. What is the goal of these land acknowledgement statements?
I think it's good to insert a bit of history and background, whether it's, you know, a short reading at the beginning of a college event, a university event, but it's a way to put things into perspective and to keep in mind that there is a history that existed here long before the existence of the United States or the colonists or the voyageurs. There were already people here with a culture and with a way of life, and it's just still practiced here.
Besides just acknowledging the land, what else has the University of Minnesota done to make it right?
Well, I think at the University of Minnesota, especially since President Gable got here, there's been a lot more interaction with the Indian tribes of Minnesota. And so in about 6 years ago, I was asked by the president's office to go out and talk with the tribes. And ultimately what the tribes wanted was more contact with the higher ups at the University of Minnesota. And so I brought that back. And then the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, which is 10 tribes in Minnesota, passed a series of resolutions. And one of the things they wanted was to meet regularly with the president. And she's been doing that. She did it 3 times last year. Even in the midst of COVID, she did Zoom meetings, and she's going to do several meetings with them this year. And she's also met with individual tribes. Like before COVID started, she went and visited Fond du Lac, which kind of a new thing. And Fond du Lac was like, we've never had a president of the University of Minnesota here before. So they wanted that. And then they also wanted us to write a joint history of the interactions between Minnesota tribes and the University of Minnesota. And so the Mellon Foundation ended up providing a grant, and we got a part of it. We essentially gave the grant over to the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council so that the tribes could write their own histories. And then we've got a group of professors working on our side that are going to form a task force with the tribes to actually write some of the things that are not real happy memories for the tribes. So the positive and the negative side of the history of the Indian people of Minnesota and the University of Minnesota. I think in the last tenure of President Gable, we've seen a whole bunch of really important strides towards making things right with the Indian tribes in Minnesota.
Although land acknowledgement is the first step, the University of Minnesota has to keep working further.
I think beyond land acknowledgement things, we're actually getting at the truth of what happened. And then we move beyond that to how do we reconcile the truth? How do we improve relations permanently? How do we create a permanent dialogue between the tribes of Minnesota and the University of Minnesota? And I think that's the most important thing we have to do. I think we have to create a dialogue that never ends.
I had to ask Professor Ted Johnson his opinion on what the university has done so far.
Well, we've got a long way to go, but I think what we've got now is a president who's going to lead us more into the 21st century with regard to American Indian policy and tribes and universities coexisting and learning from each other. And I think when we get the dialogue going, I think there's all kinds of things we need to be teaching and all kinds of things we can be learning from tribes.
The University of Minnesota is working with tribes to preserve their culture. For example, here at the Twin Cities campus, both Ojibwe and Dakota are being taught. At the Duluth campus, Professor Ted Johnson shares the programs they run.
And the Duluth campus, the programs I run are essentially best practices in running reservations, so tribal administration and governance, and tribal resource and environmental stewardship, where we actually look at what we call traditional ecological knowledge, which is like when an Indian tribe or an Indian person looks at a forest, they don't think about how many trees they can cut down. Instead, they look at the forest and they think, how do I keep the forest here for the next several generations? And so the tribes prefer to kind of leave the forest alone and let it lie. I mean, there's a lot to be learned from the Native American perspective on things.
Finally, what is the biggest takeaway of recognizing the land the University of Minnesota sits on?
In 200 years, the University of Minnesota will be here, but those 11 reservations are not moving either. They're going to be here forever. They're essentially permanent fixtures in the land. And so we have to learn to coexist and help each other, and we can learn as much from tribes as tribes can learn from us.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Casey Salazar.
With a better understanding of where the land came from, we can now start to discuss its uses and how the university has structured itself since its founding in 1851. In the next segment, we will hear from reporter Isaac Maruyama as he takes us on a journey through the controversies surrounding the names of campus buildings. Here is Isaac with more.
This is a story about names. More specifically, it's about the names of four buildings at the University of Minnesota: Kauffman Memorial Union, Nicholson Hall, Middlebrook Hall, and Coffee Hall. If you've ever walked through campus, there's a good chance you've seen most, if not all, of these buildings. But what you might not know is that their namesakes were involved in a long history of racist and discriminatory policies at the U, and that there's a movement to rename them for that reason. This all started back in 2017, when Professor Riv Ellen Prell created a museum exhibit called A Campus Divided that exposed the problematic history of certain past university leaders.
I read a small, obscure scholarly article once.
That's Professor Prell explaining how she initially began investigating Edward Nicholson, the first dean of student affairs.
And the article that I read about was the role Edward Nicholson played in passing information about student activists, both to the FBI, but also to a very powerful Republican actor named Ray Chase, who was very interested in finding information about anyone on the left wing in the 1930s.
Dean Nicholson spied on students and faculty on behalf of Republican operative Ray Chase with the goal of containing political activism and left-wing ideas on campus. Nicholson made lists with the names of anyone he viewed as radicals or communists, including students involved in the anti-war movement and the fight to end segregated housing. He also refused to recognize several left-wing student organizations and targeted anyone associated with them for surveillance.
I learned, particularly from Ray Chase, how anti-Semitic they were and how they identified Jews, not in terms of their religion, but what they viewed as their race and how dangerous they were to the campus.
Professor Prell was the director of the Center for Jewish Studies, which is ironically located in Nicholson Hall.
So here I was, going into Nicholson Hall every day, a man who was honored, who I knew already had been anti-student, anti-left-wing, opposed to student activism in the 1930s, which was the first real student movement in the United States, and who said horrible things about Jews. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice if I could just get a little plaque up in Nicholson Hall that just said, here's who this guy was. He did some good things, but he was a really problematic figure.
That's when Professor Prell had the idea to make an exhibit showing all of this that would eventually become A Campus Divided. She quickly found that Nicholson was far from the only past university leader with a complicated legacy.
Beginning in 1930, the president, Lotus Kaufman of the university, the longest serving president, created a policy of absolute racial segregation in dormitories. Dormitories that were paid by Minnesota taxpayers, some of whom were African American.
During the Kaufman administration, Vice President William Middlebrook worked to exclude students of color from university housing. After Kaufman, President Walter Coffey actively discouraged black men from living in Pioneer Hall and tried to reestablish segregated housing for black male students. A Campus Divided exposed the complicated history of these four men and many others in the university's past. And because of the exhibit, lots of people started to hear about these problems for the first time.
No exhibit in the history of the University of Minnesota has brought more people from off campus and on campus. It made people talk and think, and it made some students, graduate and undergraduate, very, very angry. And they organized a movement. And the purpose of that movement was to rename buildings that they chose, I had nothing to do with this, that they chose of the people that they found the most problematic.
In large part because of A Campus Divided, in December 2017, the Minnesota Student Association passed a resolution to rename Kaufman Memorial Union. Under President Eric Kaler, a task force was formed to investigate the possibility of renaming university buildings. Both Kaler and the task force recommended that the names of Kaufman Memorial Union, Nicholson Hall, Middlebrook Hall, and Coffee Hall be changed. But the final decision would depend on a vote by the Board of Regents.
The way the Board of Regents works, which is really quite startling, is no one is allowed to speak but them. And what happened was a small number of these regents at the first meeting to address the task force misrepresented, in some cases openly lied, and attacked the proposal. Most remarkably, one of them said, and he denied it, but he did say it, he said, wow, when I heard about this, I looked at this report and I thought I was going to see brown shirts and white sheets, meaning I was going to see Nazis and the Klan. This is what you're complaining about? This? I'm sorry, he said, but Jim Crow was the law of the land. We might not like it, but when this happened, nothing that was done was illegal.
I went through a recording of that meeting, and that really did happen.
And when I heard about this, I was expecting, you know, white hooded, brown shirt wearing racists spewing all this kind of vitriol against these people. And quite frankly, I saw administrators struggling with what appears to be a board that was holding to older positions under Plessy v. Ferguson. The Supreme Court had determined that separate but equal was not racist. Now, we look at that as an absurdity, but this is the time that they lived in. Brown v. Board wasn't for 16 years after Lotus Kaufman died.
That was Regent Darren Rocha, who's still on the Board of Regents today. And he certainly wasn't the only member of the board who shared that viewpoint.
It was horrifying. I mean, literally horrifying. I mean, I have personally never seen an experience in the university like this, where people were allowed to go unquestioned about things that they were saying, assumptions that they made about what counted or didn't count as racism or anti-Semitism.
Tensions ran high on the day the Board of Regents met to vote on whether or not the buildings would be renamed. A large crowd of students and faculty showed up to support renaming, but no one was allowed to speak unless called upon by the board.
Ma'am? Ma'am?
At one point, the crowd called for Professor John Wright, a black man whose father and aunt went to the U back when Kaufman was president, to address the board and share his perspective on what life was really like for black students at the U back then.
Who wants John Wright to speak?
The crowd literally surrounded Professor Wright to stop the police from taking him out of the room. Finally, Professor Wright was allowed to speak.
My aunt and my father were members of the very first black student organization on this campus, the Council of Negro Students, which began in 1936 here and which organized primarily to resist the policies that President Kaufman and his deans and other administrators put in place to essentially create a Jim Crow set of policies for the interaction of the races on this campus.
After a campus divided exposed the problematic history of the university's past leaders, after years of activism and raising awareness, after calls from the president of the university and the task force to rename these buildings, and after Professor Wright showed everyone just how bad things used to be, the Board of Regents finally voted to decide what would happen. The vote failed. Only one person, Regent Abdul Omari, voted in favor of renaming the buildings. And then the pandemic hit, and George Floyd was murdered. Suddenly, there were new, more pressing issues at hand, and student outrage and activism shifted focus. So where does that leave us? The movement to rename university buildings suffered a grave setback in that Board of Regents meeting, but it certainly isn't over. Right now, especially at the University of Minnesota, we have seen an unprecedented push by students and community members to acknowledge the fact that our institutions don't treat everyone fairly, and that they never have. The fight to end police brutality and the fight to rename buildings share the common goal of refusing to accept that intolerance and inequality are acceptable just because that's the way things have always been. And while A Campus Divided told the story of the rampant discrimination and racism prevalent in the U's past, it also told the story of the student activists who fought against it. In 1941, Coffey and Middlebrook created an international house with the goal of segregating African American students, and students fought against it. They integrated the International House against the wishes of the administration, which promptly shut it down at a financial loss to avoid integration. A student uprising followed, with thousands protesting segregated housing. They signed petitions, organized rallies, and eventually put enough pressure on the administration that Coffey was forced to relent and say that the U would end segregated housing.
And there were thousands of people opposing this, and the university had no choice but to back down. So this exhibit, at its core, is the story of the enormous difference students can make, not just on the campus, but really in the state, in the city, in the world, because these students saw themselves as part of all of that. And so when a student movement began to change the names on the buildings, it was a multiracial movement. They were fighting in the same spirit of those extraordinary students from the 1930s.
If A Campus Divided shows us anything, it's that students can cause very real changes in an institution if enough people care. The fight to rename university buildings is not over, and how the university responds will show whether or not we are truly committed to moving forward as a school and as a community. If you'd like to learn more about A Campus Divided and the history of oppression and discrimination at the U, check out acampusdivided.umn.edu. For Real College Podcast on Radio K, this is Isaac Maruyama.
To gain a better understanding of Minnesota's truly diverse population, me and producer Emma Morris spoke with one local resident about her past, her current work, and what is coming next. Take it away, Emma.
Casey and I recently sat down with Yusra Arab, who is currently running for a position on Ward 2 City Council here in Minneapolis. We covered many issues the ward faces, as well as her background, and here's what she had to say.
Can you introduce yourselves to our listeners? What's your name, your background, what brings you here today?
Hi everyone, my name is Yusra Arab. I'm currently running
for City Council, Minneapolis City Council for the second ward. Currently what I'm up to is we're in the midst of the virtual caucuses. We're trying to educate and kind of make the process a little bit easier for the East African populace in Ward 2, which is somewhat difficult simply because the way in which the caucuses are being conducted this year is a lot. It's very complicated. It's virtual. It requires somebody to have a computer, to be, you know, tech savvy, to speak the language. So it's been really, really difficult. So I was born in Somalia. We fled when I was around 2. Spent the first 10 years of my life in Nairobi, Kenya. I was raised by a single mom. I'm an only child, which is something that's different for Somali families. I grew up in Minneapolis, South Minneapolis, went to high school in Washburn, went out to attain my bachelor's in political science at the U. When I was done with that, my senior year there, I had my daughter who's currently 11, her name is Aisha. And then after graduating, I worked as a school age teacher in a private school in Fridley, found out that my calling in teaching wasn't there, went on to do mental health in the East African community, working with adolescents and Somali elders, kind of learn about mental health awareness, because there's stigma around mental health in the East African community. And I did that for quite some time, up until around 2017, where I volunteered in different campaigns and issues, sort of working within the East African community. And then that led me to getting a position as a policy aide in the 6th Ward. And I did that for the last 4 years. And I was working with the community in terms of like police and community relations, economic inclusion, and housing. So that is sort of where my choice to run comes from. And initially, to be quite honest with you, I had no aspirations to be a politician, right? Like that, up until even like 2 years ago, that was not something that I planned on doing. But with the events of the last 2 years and just seeing the disparities that exist and the lack of connection between communities of color and government entities, it just sort of pushed me to make that sacrifice and take up the role of running. And Ward 2, I picked it because I've lived there for the past 13 years, right? And we do have a significant communities of color in Ward 2. And it's a very segregated ward. There are no inclusions and you don't see a lot of building bridges between different communities so that they can, you know, interact with their neighbors. That doesn't exist. So those are one of the reasons that kind of propelled me to run for this position.
First off, your story is the story of so many Minnesotans, particularly here in the Twin Cities. So could you explain what it was like fleeing from war in your home country at such a young age, as well as what it was like arriving in Minnesota?
So luckily, I was really, really young, so I didn't really get to experience any of the negative effects of war, right? The only things that I know of it is the stories that I was told by my mom and my relatives and so on. And it was horrific. And luckily, my mom had the ability to... So we lived in northern Somalia, which is current day Somaliland. And there was a civil unrest there in 1988. So she kind of went through a similar experience where she had to migrate to the south, to the capital in Mogadishu. So when initially the unrest started, from what I was told, my mom felt like, you know what, let's leave. I've been through this before. And if things settle down, we'll be back. But I don't want to be stuck, right? So she left early on. So she didn't really get to experience some of the horrific things that other individuals did. But nonetheless, you know, fleeing isn't fun. And some of the stories that I was told were quite traumatizing, right? So luckily, I didn't get to experience any of that. What I remember is growing up in Nairobi, and it wasn't the most ideal way to grow up. But to me, as a kid, I didn't know any better. So to me, it was perfect, if that makes any sense. Coming to America, obviously, it's a new country, new language. It's not easy, but I was young, so it was easy for me to adapt compared to like someone like my mom or my other family members. And I actually had a really good upbringing, to be quite honest with you. And growing up in the aftermath of 9/11, obviously there were some discriminatory things that existed. Obviously you were singled out and looked at weirdly, but luckily Minnesota is one of those places where you felt home, right? You didn't really get ostracized or alienated, if that makes any sense.
You were very young when you immigrated to this country, so obviously you've had a lot of time to learn and adjust. But what was this process like for your mother, who was much older when she moved to Minnesota? What were the challenges that she faced?
Yeah, hard, because I feel like we came... So right now, the new arrivals who come to the country, right? We're Somalis are well-established in Minnesota, so you're not struggling to find anyone to help you fill out applications or get a job or get around. And so the time that when we got here, it was relatively early. And I remember my mom taking like 7 different buses to get groceries, right? Not even being able to read what's in the certain ingredients, and her being overly protective and making sure, what does this have and what does that have? And going through that and the trials and tribulations of being an early immigrant and me having to interpret for my mom at such a, you know, young age and not even quite understanding English very well and Somali. So it was really, really hard. And it still is. And she found her, she got through it, but it's the story of every other immigrant who's new to the country, right? Getting around, understanding the processes, the language. I can't even imagine going to a brand new country where you don't understand a word, right? The only time I firsthand experienced that is when I went to go, my first time out of the country, I went to Holland to go visit family, and just watching TV and not understanding a word, that is terrifying. You're like, what is happening? So then it made me think about how, you know, our parents felt coming to this country. Like how do you even begin to navigate a system that you don't understand a word of it, right? And I was such a young age that I couldn't even really help her the way that I do right now. So it was difficult, but luckily we got through it, you know?
What are some of the issues and challenges facing the wider Somali community? Are there similar themes / struggles people undergo? And is there a systemic solution to these issues?
To a certain extent, it is the same issues facing everyone. So there's a big divide between, you know, the older generation and the younger generation, right? So what we go through might be different to what our parents go through. And as you can see, the opioid epidemic, it is also affecting us at a very high rate currently. And there is a big misconception about that. And with our parents, because they don't quite understand what it is, how to deal with it, how to, you know, be aware of it or even recognize it. And we're, the community is having issues when it comes to affordable housing, when it comes to, you know, disparities in healthcare, in at every walk of life, right? And most of us do experience the same thing. All communities of color do have a common denominator. And some of those issues can be solved by the system, obviously. And others, it's just gonna be within the community itself to uplift itself and raise awareness on certain issues. So there are multiple things that are currently affecting the East African community in Minnesota, as well as, you know, other people of color as well, when it has to do with public safety. So I think one of the most, the top three issues are public safety, affordable housing, and sort of equity and inclusion, really.
You were very open about receiving Section 8 assistance when you were growing up. How did this program affect your life, and how did it affect your perspective of housing in the United States?
Yeah, so... like I said earlier, I was raised by a single mom, and she worked for 10 years at Marshall Fields as a janitor. And at the time, we were living in public housing, which is different from Section 8. Section 8, you can move around with. But with public housing, you're sort of given an opportunity to get an apartment or a house, and you stay there. You don't really quite have a choice to move around. And they bill you 30% of your income, and that's what you pay as rent. And then we had that for about 6-7 years. And finally, right around when I was 17, she was able to get her Section 8 voucher, which she waited for almost a decade. And that shows you how, you know, how affordable, and this was what, almost 20 years ago. So the issue has always been there, right? And it just, it has gotten worse. And I do think Section 8 and other voucher programs are very important in allowing families to get out of poverty, right? And giving them the chance to a better life. But it's also one of those mechanisms that kind of make families stay in a certain bracket when it comes to income, right? Because you're only a family of four can only has to have make less than $52,000 a year, which is insane when you think about it today, especially. So that kind of keeps you down almost. But for a lot of families like mine, it also gives you the opportunity to move on and get out of poverty, a road out of poverty.
In between your time as a student and a public servant, you spent time teaching second grade. How did this experience impact your opinions on the educational system in Minnesota?
So honestly, at the time I did that for 2 years, and I worked at a private charter school called Al Amal. It currently exists. And with that school, what was different is that majority of the students were students of color, right? They were giving a special focus, and they did have, you know, they did feel like they belonged and had teachers who understood their culture and their needs and so forth. And I think that has changed throughout the years. Growing up, there weren't any charter schools that were predominantly, that had students of color that were catered to certain communities. I went to public school and it was fine. Obviously, Minnesota over the years has cut back on programming when it has to do with education, right? Some of the things that we had, the extracurricular activities that we had, currently do not exist. And that's unfortunate. And that has contributed to some of the issues that we're currently facing in the cities and in communities of color when it has to do with youth and you know, the rise in crime in among adolescent populations. So clearly there's an issue there, and there's a need for more funding when it deals with education and in programming across the board.
You've spent many years living in Ward 2, and you expressed that it's heavily segregated. What does this look like, and how does it affect you and the community?
Yes, absolutely. So I've lived there for 13 years, and prior to working at City Hall, I didn't even know who my representative was, right? Because I've never seen the guy. I've never interacted with him. I've never seen him on my side of the neighborhood, which is predominantly, people of color. And I say that because I don't see any interactions between community members, right? We're not on the board of any community organization in the ward. We're not aware of it. We live there, but we're not included in any of the decision-making and any of the things that happen around the ward. And I think that isn't anything, like, it's not malicious or anything like that. I think it has to do with just, there isn't anyone who can bridge that gap, right? So you need to have someone who can say, you know what, I understand this group and I understand that group. And, you know, if I can connect the two and they have a lot of things in common, then, you know, you get, that even contributes to public safety, knowing who your neighbor is, interacting with them. It goes a long way in solving some of the issues that we currently have. And I just think we haven't had anyone do that. And not everyone is comfortable enough to, you know, reach out to the other side.
As an ex-policy advisor to City Hall with regards to community policing relations, how do you view our current landscape? What is your opinion on the verdict in the Chauvin trial? And what are your thoughts on the pending investigation with regards to Dante Wright?
I honestly think, so at my time, it was a lot of just understanding what the community needs, right? And building that bridge, right? Dialogue between law enforcement and the community, seeing what the community needs. And at my time there's different voices within the community. There's the older generation that is sort of used to, you know, the status quo and things, and don't quite understand the nuances of growing up in America and being Black in America, right? And my generation kind of did live through that understands the disadvantages that come with that and some of the issues that we currently have. And it's unfortunate because the one we all agree on that there is an issue, that there's something fundamentally wrong with policing in our country and MPD. But I think where things get lost is going about how do we change that? How do we fundamentally change the system that so that the system can be equal and serve us all and protect us all? And I think that is the biggest issue we have. We have lack of accountability. We have a system that doesn't work for us, right? That brutalizes us. And luckily we had the first step in getting somewhat accountability with George Floyd, but that's just the beginning, right? It's not just a one-off thing. This has to be the norm and not the exception. And I do hope that the same thing happens for Dante Wright and his family, that they get a sense of justice and peace in the situation. And for that police officer to be accountable for her actions, whether it was accidental or otherwise, because there is no industry in America where there's no repercussions for your failure, only in policing, which is absurd. And there are so many mechanisms in place and that were built over generations to protect these police officers. So what we need to do is dismantle those protections so that they can truly serve the communities that they say they serve. And when any of them does anything wrong, the full extent of the law is applied, just like it would be had you and I done something. And I think ultimately what we want is equal rights and accountability.
As a woman, a mother, and an immigrant, in your own words, what is the importance of diversity, especially in government?
I think now more than ever, we understand the importance of having diverse voices on the table, right? At the tables where decisions are made, because those decisions ultimately impact these individuals. So I think we would have avoided some of the issues that we're currently running into had we had actually diverse, inclusive voices at the decision-making table. And we have seen in the past years change in that. And it just needs to continue, because I think only experiencing some of these experiences and having that lived experience can you then understand the impact of the choices that you're making. You can be sympathetic and sort of feel the need of folks of color, but if you're not a person of color, you can never understand what it feels to be a person of color in America. So I think it's paramount that we have diverse voices on the table and on the decision making. And if we're genuinely caring about these communities and we're fighting for them, you should allow people of color to speak for themselves and not be the voice for them. Because I think that's what we tend to see a lot. Like, let me speak for you and I'll, fight your fight. That's not how it works. Have them fight for themselves and have them speak for themselves. That's how we truly get the actual inclusion we're all looking for, if that makes any sense.
Finally, what have we missed? And is there anything else you'd like to add?
So I would say, honestly, get involved, get the word out. Please register for caucuses, have your voices heard, because I think that is the only way in which we can truly change and see the change that we want to see. So that would be my ask. Get involved, get more information, search and speak up.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Morris.
And I'm Casey McCabe, signing off. Since Minnesota became a state in 1858, native lands have been appropriated by individuals, corporations, and state actors for various purposes. Due to this, native people were relegated to small pockets of land within the state dubbed reservations. In 1981, a United States Circuit Court ruled that the government has no say over gambling operations on reservation land, allowing for the building of numerous casinos all over the state of Minnesota. In the final segment of this special episode, we will hear from reporter Ethan Olson as he unpacks the state's history surrounding gambling and discusses what changes might be coming, and more importantly, what they might mean. Here is Ethan with more.
All the way back in January, Senator Carla Bingham and State Representative Pat Garofalo proposed their bill, which would legalize sports gambling in the state of Minnesota, something that only 27 other states have legalized. Although many thought the bill would have an easy path to completion, it is now May, and the bill is no longer close to being finalized. largely opposed by tribal gaming groups and casinos in the state. There are perhaps too many voices in the mix for a decision during this legislative session, which adjourns May 17th. This brings up the question, whose choice is it really to determine the next steps of sports gambling?
It's already done flagrantly, and it's time to shine some light on it, put some guardrails around it, protections around it, and quite honestly, we need to legalize it.
Bigham also said in her press conference with reporters that the bill includes plans for both in-house sports gambling for casinos, but also plans for online gambling services for Minnesota residents.
People have spoken. They want to bet on their favorite sports teams, and they want to do it from the couch. They don't have to go anywhere. They don't have to do anything else.
Some reports in favor of the bill have claimed that by legalizing sports gambling, the state government could take in up to $40 million per year with a 5% gambling tax. But the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association estimates that instead, the tax revenue would be closer to $6 million per year, with casinos set to lose more if online gambling is legalized.
I just wanted to clear up that Native Americans do pay taxes, and gaming is conducted by Indian tribes on Indian land. It is by Indian government on government land to be put back into our community. And the right stems from pre-constitutional sovereign entities, and only federally recognized tribes can open casinos, not state, they can't do that.
This is Raina Curran, a Native American student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an advocate for keeping gambling in the physical casinos. She tells me that a continued standstill is a good thing for casinos, partnered by the fact that Governor Tim Walz wants sports gambling legalized only if done exclusively through already existing tribal casinos that have licensed with local government.
With tribes and their state compacts, it is just like a sort of business agreement between tribes and states. So if Minnesota did do this, it would kind of be going back on that business pact that they made. And it really does help stimulate the local economy. And many reservations where there are tribal casinos, not all of course, but a lot of them are in poverty due to institutional racism and just how the United States thrives on the genocide of Native Americans.
With interest in gambling partially online, naturally attendance at physical casinos decreases, and therefore there is a need for less jobs. Jobs needed by those employed from the nearby reservations. For example, a casino in North Dakota, Spirit Lake Casino, reported that last year they employed around 300 jobs to the Spirit Lake Nation, a population where only 61% of its adults were employed, and 20% lived under the poverty level, according to census figures.
There's all sorts of jobs. There's like car dealers, you know, there's the people that wash the security tapes. There are people that are the gift shop. My auntie on the Menominee Reservation, Christina, she worked in the gift shop for a very long time.
Native gaming does have a part in the final decision. So as long as there's no agreement met before May 17th, the state of Minnesota could be looking at an even longer wait for legal sports gambling. And it doesn't look like they're changing their minds anytime soon. When asked for a quote, I was fed a formal statement that reads, "The Minnesota Indian Gaming Association continues to oppose the expansion of off-reservation gambling, including the legalization of sports betting." This is Ethan Olson, reporting for the Real College Podcast.
That's all for this extra special episode of Real College Podcast. All of us here at Radio K would like to recognize that the content presented in this episode represents only part of a greater collective Minnesotan identity. Each unique piece of that puzzle is what makes this state such a wonderful place to live, and it wouldn't be the same without you, the listener. Stay safe out there, and we hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.